Let's see, today's the 27th, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
March 27th. Mm-hmm. What is your full name?
Forrest Bloom.
I understand you're not a native of Tucker County. You're
no, Fayette County.
Fayette County. Fayette's an interesting county. Where from down there?
Lookout. On just a wide spot on in the road on Route 60. 10 miles above, about 12 miles above Hawk's Nest, towards Virginia line, towards Raynell, in that area.
Tell me something about your people over in there.
My people?
Yeah.
Well, my granddad was one of the very first settlers there on the Midland Trail, and the old home place is still standing. He had a 180-acre farm to start out with. It ended up split between about five of his kids. Uh-huh. Each one of them, he'd give them 10, 12-acre plots of property. And him, or his old home place, and two old maid aunts, and one other aunt that married is only two still living on the farm today.
But they're still there, are they?
Old home place is still there with the two aunts. One of them must be close to, oh, she has to be in her 90s. And my granddad was 90, lived to be 98. And of course, he was about dead three or four times. He told him, said, don't worry about me, we'll live to be 98. Well, he liked 10, 12 days making it. But,
what was his name?
Oscar Bloom. My dad's name was George Oscar, and he lived to be 53. But about all the boys died young, all but one. He died shortly after I came up here. He was 76, I believe, when he died. But the old man lived to be 98. Their mother died quite young.
Where was Oscar Bloom born?
He was...
You say he was one of the first settlers in that country.
They was born over around... It's over in Virginia, but I can't think right now of the name of the place. And they come in through here, walked in a wagon to Lewisburg, what little bit's been run back on them. Then they made it on in to Lookout. And the first jail in Fayette County was on his farm. It was just a small log jail. As a matter of fact, in my times, I can remember part of the foundation standing for the thing, and it had a big too high pole fence with a big rail across the top of it going into the entrance of it, which is now close to the, you know, the cemetery is the next entrance.
So you're what was you in a great big family of kids then?
No, there was only five in my family, but in my granddad's or my grandmother's, my mother's family, there's 24.
What?
And three, my grandpa was married three different times, but he's 13 in my mother's immediate family. And she was the first one to pass away, and she passed away in 1970. And since then, there have been a couple more of them passed away, but...
Who were they?
Beavers. They was Beavers, and some of the older ones was fought in the Civil War, even, on the thing. And my oldest uncle, he still lives in California, he tells about going to work. He was a trapdoor boy in the coal mines. When he went to work, and he's 13 years old in coal mines, and worked for many, many years. And when they took him into service, they settled out in California. Stayed, they was in the Air Force as farmen, and they stayed on as farmen as in private life out there. Two or three of them did. So they was a rather large family of them. Matter of fact, there are some of them that I never even met, some of my granddad's first people that I never even met out from his first wife. I think he had three or four from them, and the rest of them in the next two.
What was his name?
John William Beaver.
Was he in the Civil War?
No, he was, that was before his time. I'm wrong about Civil War. I'm mistaken about that. These boys are all in the Second World War. I don't know where I got Civil War. Now, Granddad was during the Civil War time, but I don't think he ever served in it. I don't know where I come up with that part of it. Now, my grandmother used to tell a pretty interesting story about how she ended up in West Virginia. She was somewhere in Kentucky. She didn't even know really where. And she had a stepfather. When she was about 11 or 12 years old, well, she ran to keep him from molesting her. And she ended up with some politician in Charleston, took her in, and kept her for, she stayed there, went through part of her grade school. I believe she said she stayed there around 3 or 4 years. Then somehow or other, she ended up 60 miles on up the road from Charleston. And she married my granddad when she was very young. He was considerable older than her. Matter of fact, he passed away a couple years before I was born. And I'm 54 years old, so he passed away just about the time my brother, this older than me, was born. And my grandmother, she didn't pass away till somewhere in around 66, I believe, when she passed away, 1966. She lived to be 88 also. But she tells how he mistreated her, how she got across the river, Ohio River, and all this stuff. She really sat down and talked to my brother in Ohio before she died one time. He sat and talked with her a good bit, and she told a very interesting story, which I never got to really hear from her, which I'd love to have heard, but I didn't.
Did you go to school right around Lookout?
Went to Divide, they called it, school. It's now, it's still there, but then Nuttall High School, which is Midland Trail now, where since it combined the school, and they moved it to Hyco area, about halfway between Lookout and Anstead is where it's at now. But we went to school there, Winona, Danies, Cliff Top, and all of them ended up at Nuttall High School. But the grade schools was pretty well separate. They was pretty well into the, smaller towns. Each had a grade school. But when it come high school, they come from over on Meadow River and all over the place to the high school. But the old school's still standing and everything, but I don't think they use it for anything now. They did use a gym up there for a while, but I think they finally got one built at that place.
So you finished high school there?
I finished high school in the service. I went to work when I was 16 years old. Had the misfortune of, I guess it's misfortune looking back on it now, my granddad's, The three old maids at the time that was staying there, never married at the time, they kept boarders and had the misfortune of Bartlett Tree Experts working there and staying there. And I got to know some of them and got to work doing summer jobs. And then my dad got down his back, nobody was working, so I just worked on through there after that. And while I was in Korea, we went to school over on the pier to finish her education, and just right before we was to take the test, the pier burnt down. So I didn't get to finish up there. So after I came back and worked all 2 or 3 years, I went to West Virginia Tech and went ahead and finished up my education down there, always there.
And that's where you took up forest?
No, I worked for, I had a, her, my wife's brother went to work in 1955, and he came back out of the service about 8 or 10 months before I did. And he tried to talk me into coming. At that time, I was paying something like $195 a month. And I didn't think I could take care of a wife and kid on $195 a month. So I elected to go to work at the factory. Then I always sort of had a, after knowing that he had, what he'd done and everything, sort of had a hankering for the job, but just never did have the time. And so I was off with a, I had a double hernia operation, so while I was off, I went down and took a test and everything. Got time to, you know, go take the civil service test and so on and so forth. And that's when I ended up getting into it. Well, about a year later, really, before I went to work for them. So.
Were you in Tucker County by that time?
Or? No, I never even heard it. Well, I knew there was a Tucker County, but I didn't know where it was at. When I went down to apply for the job, it was one opening in Tucker County and one Mouse Storm, Grant County, and opened down in down below Charleston on the river. And so we looked at the map and found out where Tucker County was, and I said, well, right there is probably where I'll end up, and that was where I ended up. So. No, I'd never been to Tucker County in my life, never been to Randolph County, never been up this part of the country at all at that time. So
what year was it?
68. In 68 when I came up here, and been here ever since.
How did you like it?
I like it. In my type of work, I love it. But there are a lot of things we had to do, a lot of getting used to. To start out with, it snowed, I think, ever started early that winter.
How do you describe your job? What do you do exactly?
Well, you've been here about 15 minutes. I think you can see what we do a good bit of. In a rural county like this, about everything, just to be truthful with you. From dog catcher, I had a woman call me today on bulldozers running up and down the road, leaving, cutting the roads up and tracks and stuff. But really our main job is game and fish and highway litter and litter on private lands, and which is all law officers' jobs, but we end up with the bigger part of it. The rest of them won't hardly mess with the litter. We take care of all the DNR warrants, if reclamation or water resources or anybody like this makes the investigation and finds reasons for the right citation or get warrants, well, we end up serving the warrants on them. So they've got us loaded up pretty heavy, really, for as few of us as they are. We're about 116 or something like that.
So you're with the Department of Natural Resources?
Right.
We're law
enforcement section, yeah. And now I understand that the legislature seemed in their heart to add air pollution. And there was another energy enforcement on to us. So I don't know what that's going to consist of. But they load us down with everything but money. They forget us when it comes time for the money, but they like to put, if they, it seems like when they get down there and something new comes up and nobody else knows what to do with this, they give it to conservation officers. But when it comes time for money, they don't know we exist, really. But, it's a lot better. It used to be, like I say, in 1955, it paid $195 a month. It's what the going rate was. And we've stayed just about on an even keel up until 1968, then it did pick up a little bit. Then we started fading out again here in the last 4 or 5 years. We started losing ground again in the last 4 or 5 years of it. But,
yeah, it's been a rough time. I expect you've had, Have you ever run up against any pretty tough customers in the woods?
Not really that bad. You just don't know which one's going to be a rough customer and which isn't. Now, if you ever stop a young man in the woods unexpectedly, the first thing he does, he'll point that gun right in your stomach every time. Reflexes. Not he's going to shoot you, but you don't know this. But any time, I mean, like pre-season squirrel hunting, which we don't have much of up here, well, you step out behind a tree on him, he'll throw that gun on you every time. But other than that, of course, when you're after a spotlighter, you don't know what he's got in mind. But you always try to keep him between you and the lights if you can after you get started. But when you walk up to the car or have him get out of the car, you hope he's not going to do nothing. So far, I've been awful lucky. Nobody's ever tried anything at all on me. So, been awful lucky with that.
Got a reasonable sort of a feeling about you. I don't think anybody ever would probably get real jumpy around you.
No. When you go out there, you have to go out there with attitude. You know it, or I do. That you're gonna be careful. You're not gonna let him get the jump on you. And it don't bother me. Maybe I'm a fool for not letting it bother me, but it don't bother me because I always try to go prepared when I go on something like it. A lot of times we'll get called 3 o'clock in the morning on a spotlight case. Well, you don't get someone else to go with you in a rural county at 3 o'clock in the morning, so you go. You do whatever you have to do, and so far we've been very fortunate. I think we've had, in the history of the conservation office, we had 2 men killed in the whole history of law enforcement section of it. And the last one was killed over a letter. It was a letter deal. The magistrate was going to allow the fella to pick up, so he was being a good guy and take him to his house to change clothes. And he went in the house. And when he didn't come back out, as soon as this boy thought he should, he went to see why, and he pulled a rifle on him and shot him right in the eye with a 30-06 rifle. So, you know, you don't know which one's a...
Was that in Pawpaw? Was that in Pawpaw that happened?
That was down at...
I'm thinking of another case.
Down on the Virginia line, Peterstown, in that area, yeah.
Monroe County.
Monroe County's where it's at, yeah, right. And this hadn't been so many years ago, 5, 6, 7 maybe. Time gets away from you after a while. It's probably been 7 or 8 years ago this happened. But then we thought he was the first, but then somebody come up at one was killed back in the early years by a moonshiner or something that they went in on. But we've been awful fortunate in our job because statistics shows that, you know, it is a much more dangerous job than most law enforcement does have because you're out away from the general public most of the time and so on and so forth. But you got to let them think you're in command whether you are or not. I think that helps. I really do. I think if you'd back up a drop from them, I think they'd take advantage of you, a lot of them. And, of course, you run into people you don't know, and with today's thing with drugs and all this, you don't know what you're running up against when you have to stop somebody or something. But like I say, it don't bother me. And I don't know whether that's good or bad, really, I don't, that it don't bother me.
But, well, the nice part of your job is that you have a chance to observe nature real.
A whole lot of getting out and not working in a looking at four walls all day or a punch hole in the mines, which I have done. And it's, yes, there. A lot of good points in it. My wife's got a saying, and I think she's about half right. I think a conservation officer is born and not made. And I actually believe that. I think you have to have it in your heart that you want to protect the environment and the game and so on and so forth. It's this almost, which is a sad thing, but it's this almost beat a non-hunter out of me. I've seen so much people killing this to be killing, you know, not for the meat or anything. I've seen people hog fish up behind the fish truck. I love to fish before I came up here. I can swim more than hard even fish on account of it, because, you know, they take the sport out of something like that. Well, that to me, that kills it. And they really do. They up here, that trout truck means more to them around than whether they're going to get to work next week or not. But, I mean, this is a small percentage of them, but it shows, sticks out like a sore thumb when you got
it
something.
It must be the same everywhere, because before I lived here, I came from Hampshire County. And that's the way it was over there.
Yeah. Fish.
We lived right on a little trout stream, and they stocked it. Boy, there was the same crowd. There's always the following.
Same people, over and over and over, year after year after year, and I've seen them raise their kids now, and they're taking over. Or since I've been here that long.
You're getting to see a second generation.
Second generation, and some
truck followers.
In a couple cases, third generation has got started now. So the truck followers especially. Now, the hunting up here, I don't think they're quite that greedy on it. A lot of the violations that we get in hunting is few young fellas just, I don't know what they're calling, but you know, it seems like after you get a little older, people get to looking at it and saying, well, you know, if I don't stop, there's not going to be nothing left for my children, and so on and so forth. And some of the biggest violators we got, well.
Morning, Hank.
You know, they, after a few years, they're the ones that helps us out the most. So it seems like they see the light after a while. I'm still waiting on Hank to see it, but he hasn't seen it yet.
He's still spotlighting a lot, isn't he?
I have to watch him behind the feast truck. No, Hank does pretty good.
Do you need cigarettes, Hank? Have you noticed any changes in the 18 years in the ecology in terms of timbering or mining, or has any of the extractive industries had any effect on wildlife, do you feel?
Right.
Or watersheds?
We've seen a big change. We have this experimental forest up here, Inferno Forest, and they've done a lot of clear cutting, which over the years has made it good for the deer cover. Now, they claim deer, it would help all of it, but I can't really see nothing but deer. Maybe a little bit of, maybe a little better on the turkey. Now, we've come up a good bit on the turkey in the 18 year I've been here. We got a pretty good flock in here, then all of a sudden they got in a big way of trapping and moving them to the other parts of the state. And being a wildlife man just about to fight over that, he would catch a flock of 20, he would take 20. And I argued with him, now you throw out an old hen, a couple old hens and a rooster out of that, and you haven't, you know, ruined a flock of turkeys. But they was going for numbers, I think, more than anything else, and I think possibly this was wrong, but they seemed to come right back. It didn't seem to hurt them all that bad after over the years. Of course, then this doe season come in, and this really shook up the population around here, because, well, it did me too. I'll have to admit, I thought it was a ruination of the deer herd, because I felt, being raised on a farm, if you kill the cows, your calf's gone. But it hadn't proved out that way hardly at all. You take somebody when they is young and then clear cut of this being cut, I know I've got a couple friends that thinks the deer herd is completely gone, because their favorite hunting spot is no longer, you know, loaded down with deer. But if they go down the road 10 mile or 5 mile, they're going to find just as many deer or more. But the biggest change I've seen in Tucker County is when I first came here in 68, they were no young people at all. There's either school age or older people. There's nobody in between. Everybody was away trying to make a living somewhere. Then the mines got to open up on the mountain and they got to dwindling back. And it was, matter of fact, I was 38 years old when I came up here, and it was a pretty lonely place because there wasn't very many people, my wife and I's age group, around any place at the time. And we found it a little hard to adjust. The people were different up here from what it was in Fayette County. Just a lot of difference. They, well, matter of fact, she worked.
He was talking about the difference of people.
They was what we always considered New English type. They didn't welcome you in. Two or three people did, but the rest of them, they sort of, here you're the damn old mean game warden, we're stand backish people. Now, I don't know whether it's the same if you'd been in another form of work. And my wife worked for City Hall. She started probably a year after we came up here. And the mayor told her, you know, they'd accept us within 5 years. Well, she advised them real quick, it didn't need them after 5 years. We can make it 5 years out them, we don't need them. But we found this, where I lived in Fayette County before we came up here was a small, company. There's company houses that had been sold public. It was a boomer below the alloy plant. And there was 10 houses on each side of the street. And you didn't know what it was. That somebody wasn't coming or going out in and out of your house at all times. I mean, everybody was neighbors, and you come and went as you seen fit down there. If you went out to work on a car, you just well figure there's going to be five or six men out talking to you and keeping you from working on your car and so on and so forth. But up here, it was quite a different thing. It
not nearly so sociable.
Oh, not nearly, but I contributed part of that to the type of job I was doing, because the people up here at that time still thought if a deer come on their land, that belonged to them, must come on their land, and they didn't like, and still don't. And I can't say that they're all wrong in it. Don't like anybody telling them what they can do on a piece of land they buy, pay for, and pay taxes on. They feel if they want to hunt on it year-round, well, that should be their privilege. It belongs to them. And it seemed like when I came here that people had an awful bad taste in their mouth for the game warden. It was a bad deal. They'd had a couple experiences up here before I came at one officer ended up shot in the arm. It's still unknown whether he shot himself or what happened on the thing. I've heard different stories, but never have heard the straight of it. And I had another officer come in here, and he tried to play state police and stopped the judge's daughter from over to Elkins and told her he was one of the state police over here, when indeed he didn't last too long till he either was fired or asked to quit. I don't know what did happen with him. But when I came here, they was very gun shy. When they put me over here, they told me the day I was came from Fairmont, which is my district also, and over here, to not to do a thing unless the other officer was with me. And he even got as strict on the thing as if you see a man walking down the road with a deer on his back, it's not deer season, you leave him alone till you get with the other officer. And, of course, the captain was on vacation. This was second in command. So after I'd done this for about 8 months, well, they was evaluating us, and they went in, and they was about ready to let me go. And the captain wanted to know why I wasn't working for myself, and I told him I had orders not to work for myself. And the very man giving me the orders jumped up and said, well, who in the damn hell give you an order like that? I said, you did, sir. And he sat down real quick. I think the wheels got turning. So at this point, the captain asked me if I was afraid of the job. I said, no, sir. Are you afraid of me? I said, no, sir. I'm not afraid of no man. I might be a fool, but I'm not. You know, if that's what you're trying to put out, that, you know, I'm afraid to get out there and work for myself, but I've given the order. And I was always taught when you're given the order, you try to obey. And I said, that I had it made, really. I mean, I didn't have to make no decisions at all the first 8 or 9 months. Everything was on the other officer's back. But the lieutenant, the other officer, and myself was only 3 people that knew this. The rest of them thought, well, you know, he's not catching on at all. He's not taking his job serious. He's sitting back. But after we got that straightened out, well, you know, I had no more problems whatsoever. But I told him it's hell to get fired for following orders, but the captain agreed with me after that.
Wouldn't be the first time.
No, that's for sure. That is for sure. But since then, I have no... have had no problems. Well, I didn't have any then, a note of until that day, but no problems at all with the job. Of course, our job ends, we can go to work at 9 o'clock, quit at 6, and it ends. You can see that already, can't you? That's what they think at the district office yet. They think when we're off, we're off. They don't think we're doing the same thing all day, all evening long that they do and get paid for all day long. They cannot believe that. They'll come over here for deer season and one of them and work with you, and they'll get the idea of what's going on, but 15 minutes later, they forget it. My wife kept a log 1 year at the calls, and I believe in 3 days before deer season, she had 4 pages of names on a yellow legal pad. I believe it was 4 pages she had of calls about different things, you know. But, a lot of them actually wants to know about the laws and wants to know what to do to keep them breaking the laws where they'd be safe out there. A lot of them just, after you get to know them, I get calls sometimes from the old farmer out here that I've known since I've been in the job. It'd be a bad day and he just wants somebody to talk to for an hour. And of course, it's all part of the job. You got to have it, I guess. I guess they try to tell us we don't, but I think to operate and operate efficient in a county, you have to have this kind of relationship with the people. If you don't, I feel when you go to court with a case, your chances of winning is pretty thin. And if you've got good relation with the people, I think, and they know that you don't get out and drink and this and that and the other thing, I think they'll take you for what you are. I think the case is a lot easier to win and everything due to this. Of course, we get into times that you couldn't win a case if your life depended on it, but Hank can verify that, I think. But there's a lot more to it than just putting the gun on coming out here, I feel.
In the case of a natural disaster, then, you would probably feel responsible to the community on 2 levels, both a personal level and a professional level.
Very much so, yes.
In case of a forest fire or a flood or what have you, you'd want to be out there.
Right. We're in a hassle now, I guess you call it a hassle, with the state over hours worked. The 18 years I've been here up until a year ago, we worked all the hours it was necessary. Well, you worked all you could stand, put it that way. When you had to come in and rest, you come in and rest. But especially in occasions such as a flood or deer season or busy times, you just worked. That was it. You worked 7 days a week. You changed your days for, you didn't take none off during deer season, but for years and years and years, I changed my days to fit the stocking schedule. You never knew when you was going to be off or nothing like this. And so the night of the flood, I heard dispatch some of the EMT people out evacuating people. So knowing what a hassle was in and everything, I called my captain. And I told him it sounded like we was getting some high water here, and it sounded to me like it's going to be necessary to to hit the road and see what could be done and everything like this. And all I could get him to tell me, well, if they need you, work. If they call on you, work. So I didn't know it was getting near as serious as it was at this time, but because a lot of times, you know, they've hired wolf before and it didn't amount to anything. The biggest we ever seen, that used to be when she worked City Hall and it was on the river down there, we'd go down and carry the records upstairs and go down the next morning, put them back down, and everything was all right. But this, after calling him in, I sat around here probably another 40, 45 minutes, listened to the scanner, and Miss Barb called me, one of her magistrates, and she wanted to know if I would try to go down and go in her drugstore and turn the computer off. She had a brand new computer, and they thought the water was going to get up that high, and so I advised her, yeah, I'd go do it. And she said, you might not be able to get down there. Of course, I made a promise I haven't kept yet, and I hope I don't have to, but I told her I could get there, but I never did. Anyway, by the time I got there, there's 3 feet of water up on the drugstore already. That's how fast it came up. And so I went up to get the key from Bob Keller, who is one of the druggists down there, and get a pair of wading boots. And I'm still going to try to make it. By the time we got back down there, it was up better than half on our door. And so we decided at this point, I asked him if he had insurance. He said, yeah, that's one thing we got plenty of. I said, well, if we open that door, we're going to do more damage than what we would otherwise. So we decided we wouldn't. So I took him back to the house. He'd had a bad heart attack here less than a year ago, and I didn't see any sense having him out there in that, so I took him back on the hill to his house. And this time, they got the call, and the word came that a fire truck had got washed away down the Holly Meadows. And they brought the farming in. And there's a bunch more farming on the other side of the river that they didn't know nothing, you know, they had no contact with, and they couldn't get back. The bridge had washed out, and so on and so forth. That was Hank up there in that house, I think, at the time. So this one thing led to another there. Then some of them got to trying to see if Hank's family is out of the jail. And so we checked on that and found out that they had this taken them out of the jail, and that the chief of police, the ex-sheriff, and the city police, which is the ex-sheriff's son, was going to take a boat and go in and get the people out of jail. Well, the foreman came out there and wanted me to help him with some, one of the foremen, he wanted me to help him with some stuff around the fire hall there since he had all them men in the hospital. So started helping him a little bit there. Then next thing I know, here comes some boys running up, and they said that the boat broke loose at the sheriff, or ex-sheriff, and the chief of police and his son, and went after them, and the boat, the rope broke, and the boat got away from him. I said, well, where are they at now? He said, the last time I seen it, it's bouncing around off in that big high fence around there. I said, still, the boat's all right then. The boat's still afloat. Yeah, the boat's still afloat. So we started running like a chicken, or I did, chicken's head cut off, trying to get enough rope to try to get it tied off. And get. But this time, the water done hit Main Street and was up probably 2 foot in the upper street already. And we started trying to get around to them, and about this time the power goes off. Here are a couple big booms and no more power. And so it was probably a good thing it did, because a bunch of us got electrocuted probably had, and all that water around the red light and everything up there. So we was trying to send some boys to try to get a boat motor. We had a little boat there, but we didn't have no motor for it. And no, we didn't have a boat. Wrong. They knew where a boat was at that we could get, but there wasn't no motor for it. So they started after a motor one way, and we started looking for a motor back on the hill, some people I knew that had motors. Anyway, this went on probably for an hour, running around there like a chick with his head cut off, trying to get some way to get them fellas before they went to Pennsylvania. And one of the EMTs come out of the senior citizen's home up there, the new home they built down here. And she had a walkie-talkie. And I asked her, I said, do you have contact with anybody in the jail? And she said, yeah, the EMTs upstairs. I still got contact with them. I said, well, ask them if they can see or know what happened to the chief of police and them. So she did. And they said, oh, they're up here with us. And what had happened all this time, they tied the boat when they went in to get the prisoners out. They tied it. And the water came up so fast, it raised the boat and broke the rope. And the boat was floating around, but them people thought they seen the boat, they thought the men were still in at the time, but they was actually out of the boat. So about this time, I come back out and was coming up the top of the hill to contact somebody. Anyway, at this before this happened, well, Elkins Operation Center come on the radio. And we had the only, after the power went off and the phone went out, that was the only contact in and out of Parsons was what I had there, talking to her. And she was getting questions from Charleston. This is two disasters I went through. And same thing happened the other time. Then people at Charleston wants a word, blow-by-blow description of everything that's going on. And so I spent about the next hour trying to tell her what had went on to the point and this and that, and she kept shooting questions to me. So finally, I just told her, lady, if I don't get out of this damn car, I can't tell you nothing else. If I don't get away from this radio, because I'm sitting here talking to you, and that's all I'm getting done. So with that, I just proceeded to hang the mic up and get out of the car and go to see what I could do. Someone was needing something. I come back uphill, and I met this. I'd heard that Bob Moore had got washed away at Holly Meadows. And so as I started uphill, I met him coming. So I stopped talking to him, and I said, Bob, I'm glad to see you, because I'd heard you got washed away. He said, no, my daughter Amy. And I said, Amy? He said, yeah, you know Amy, worked down at the News and Novelty. I said, yeah. But I didn't know she was his daughter. I knew she was a Moore, but I didn't know whose daughter it was. And so about that time, his wife started screaming, where's the farming at? I said, well, lady, last count I had is all in the hospital. It was down there, the fire truck upset, and they're all in the hospital down here. And she said, well, who's going to look for my daughter? I said, lady, till now I didn't know you had a daughter lost. And I mean, with that, she went into hysterics. Couldn't get no help, couldn't do this, couldn't do that. So finally I told her, I said, now just settle down and tell me what happened and so on and so forth, and maybe we can get some help down there. Of course, at that point, who do you get? And so her husband went ahead and told me what happened then, that they was on the Jeep. The Jeep had turned over. They was hanging on to the roll bar on it, and she couldn't swim, and they told her to hold on. And about that time, the water picked the thing up and flipped it again and flipped them out toward shore and didn't know where she went. So with that, of course, first thing went through my mind, and she couldn't swim, so they said. So the first thing went through my mind, you know, she didn't have a prayer. But there's two or three people there with them, so we sort of more or less organized them to walk along the shoreline down there and just look, because, you know, we figured the water throwed them into shore. There might be a chance it throwed her into shore, knocked her cuckoo or something, and she was still could possibly be all right. But truthfully, down deep, I didn't feel that there's any chance we'd ever see the girl alive again. With the way the water is rolling down through there and the fact that she couldn't swim, I thought it would be impossible to ever see her alive. So we went ahead and we took them down there, went down and let them have what lights we had and so on and so forth. At this time, see, the firehouse was plumb out of it because they had me and all of them gone but one fella. And I don't think he was too familiar with the firehouse. What wasn't in the hospital was on the other side of the river. So we couldn't gather up no equipment. This is where we've always depended on for equipment, the fire hall, really. And so about this time, someone came up, but there was a bunch of people at St. George trapped in a house. And elderly people in a rest home down there, trapped in the house. And that they, Mr. Goss was going down in his boat and try to get them out. So we proceeded to go down there and see if we could be of help down there. And at this time, the water was up probably 6 inches on the second story windows. When they broke the window, upstairs window, the water went in instead of out in the second story window, that thing. So we stayed there probably 15, 20 minutes and seen that, you know, they was getting them out all right and there's nothing we could do. So we proceeded. At this time, the water broke over twice, broke over the new bridge down there at St. George, is how high it was. It broke from the back end and came up over in a big wave across the thing. So we left out of there and came back into Parsons then. In the meantime, I was trying to tell the people, keep the people in Elkins up on what was going on and so forth. But I get a little ahead of my story there. Started telling them that we needed the National Guard or somebody in there to help us. That we had no facilities to do anything. No, we needed lights, we needed boats, we needed a pretty good sized motor. And so at this time, they started calling for the National Guards. And about a half hour later, she called back and she told me this time the water was getting really high. And she told me the National Guards couldn't start till in the morning. And so I just said it the way I thought it. I just told her straight over the radio, no damn use of sending them in the morning. We won't need them. There won't be nothing left here to use them for in the morning. And so we had a little radio silence there. And she came back and she said, well, some of the men's going to start here from Elkins. They got a couple boats and some of the DNR people's going to start. But they already know they couldn't get into 219. They know they couldn't go to Davis, Canaan, or Canaan and 2. So they started down from Billington. So a half hour to 45 minutes later, they called back and said they can't get there either because the bridge is out of Billington. They can't get across it. Well, unbeknownst to me, over Fairmont, they had been monitoring everything that was going on. And the captain had started 3 conservation officers and wildlife man over this way. They started 2 from Fairmont and let's see,